Wes Hurd presented his intellectual autobiography as the third talk in a series entitled Coming to Truth on January 23, 2008 at McKinsey Study Center's Wednesday night class. Copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay. We're continuing in a series, I think. Am I at a third one? We just want to present, have some folks who hang around here, tutors, faculty, and other people around the community here, give a little bit of their story. And the purpose of the story is to give some account of their spiritual journey with a kind of emphasis on the intellectual, philosophical problems or issues that the person confronted in the path from where they began in their Christian faith and where they are today. So the focus is on why, in a sense, in the end, it's very simple. Why do you believe that Christianity is true? And so my great fear tonight is that I'm going to bore you to death, so I'll do my best. So this will be a narrative, an unfolding of my own story. And then I'm basically, in effect, going to sprinkle observations that occurred to me on my path along the way. My beginnings through the early 10 years of my life as a Christian were not intellectually oriented, hardly at all. I was raised in a Christian family in a little small town in Southern California called Claremont, California. And from the time I was that high, I remember going to a little Baptist church there. And nothing remarkable, very small little Baptist church that actually had some Southern Baptist roots and then had become a different denomination of Baptist. And I remember sitting in church and drawing pictures of Jesus, my early art. Draw pictures of Mom and Jesus, and Mom really liked it. And that's how I got started in my art. So nothing particularly remarkable. I grew up with the idea that God was there. When I reached junior high and high school, of course, sports and parties and girls became much more important than thinking about church. And I remember the experience of going to church and thinking, and then getting out of church and feeling, yeah, I did it. All right, I went to church. And that's about as far as it got through a certain point in high school. And I went through a rather traumatic experience in high school of playing, being in a major sport and behaving badly and being removed from the team. And it was really shocking and very traumatizing to me, because that and one or two other things really made up my world at that time. And I remember going back to church sort of more seriously or more in a more somber, serious mode. And I stopped hanging around with a lot of the people that were my so-called friends who actually got in trouble with me. And I remember the next summer, it was my senior year, I graduated, spent the summer, went on a vacation with my parents to the High Sierras and took my Bible with me. And I don't even remember why I took my Bible. I just knew I wanted to take my Bible. And I took a couple of pals with me, the only guys I hung around with at that time. And I remember going off by myself and just cracking the Bible open and reading the Bible. And there was no... I think it was my spiritual intuition at work indicating to me that life, I was beginning to feel life in a way that was bigger than being just a kid, and the world was bigger, and my sense of where I was going and why I was here and how was I going to be safe in this world, and how was I going to be, was I going to be happy in this world? Those questions were starting to emerge in my life for the first time. And somehow the Bible was connected to that. And I remember going to church one Sunday morning in August, about a month before I went off to college. And in the Baptist church, they have altar calls. And I remember sitting in a row with my family, on the end of the row. And that was where I could get out fast. And the sermon and the preacher teaching that morning. And somehow, when he got to the end, I was just crushed. I had an experience of just feeling crushed. And I look back on it, I don't know. At the time, I didn't have my adult mind and brain. I can't look back at it very analytically, except to say that I knew that God wanted me. That's the way I talked about it. And so I walked forward in this little Baptist church and did what good Baptists do. They give their lives to the Lord. And that's what I did. And it was huge. That was huge for me. Because I had not taken my faith seriously or given much much thought to it in a way that I can actually remember. And about a week later, I had made this commitment. Something definitely happened. I was definitely reconnected with God somehow. I did not understand the gospel. As I think back on it now, that Christianity, if you had asked me to explain the gospel at that point, I don't think I could. It would have had something to do with Jesus and his death and the forgiveness of God. But it was just the most generic understanding. But it was a profound conversion. And I remember there was one other moment, seemed as I was recollecting this experience and thinking back through to prepare my thoughts tonight. I remember deciding that I had to go to the Bible study youth group in order to demonstrate that I was serious about it. And I was genuine in that. And I remember driving up toward the foothill where this Bible study was going to be happening, or whatever it was. And again, I didn't identify with the kids that were there. I had no idea. I mean, I just had no social relations with them at all. It was just me deciding to go because it was what seemed like God would have me do. And I remember stopping at a stop sign that was about a quarter of a mile from where the house was. And there was this, it was a stop sign where you had to go right or left. And it was up in a, back in those days, they still had orange groves in Southern California. I was kind of in the middle of an orange grove up near the foothills. and I sat there at that stop sign. There was nobody behind me. I sat there and I thought, am I going to do this? And that, just sitting at that stop sign for probably 30 seconds was perhaps in some ways more significant in terms of authenticating the fact that I was committed to this thing, this new life, this new way of looking at life and finding out whatever that meant, following God. And I decided, yep, I'm going to do this. And turned and went to the Bible study. It's funny how those things come back and you think, wow, I could have gone the other way and it probably would have been, I mean, that might have been the end of it. But I didn't. The first part I'm going to talk about, I don't know how else to talk about this except phases, so I'll call them phases in my life. The first phase was right after that I went off to college, and as I said, I did not have a solid understanding of what it meant to be a Christian, I didn't understand the gospel very clearly at all, very superficial understanding. But I did meet a fellow who was a senior and was the dorm counselor in my dorm that year, and he was a committed Christian and was took me under his wing, and he was a great fellow and quite an athlete, but very serious in his faith, and he drew me in under his wing and started taking me to Bible studies. And in college, in this first phase, the first part of my recollection at this point is that I started to understand more through these Bible studies, and I didn't really have a church home for the first couple of years while I was in college. I'd go to different churches. But the thing that did hit me was, for the first time in my life, I started to come to terms with my own personal evil. I started to come to terms with the fact that my grandma, Griffith, when I was growing up, she was from the South. And if you know anything about people from the South, I heard this the other day and it clicked for me. My grandma would always say to me, "Now you be a good boy. You're a good boy." And that's a very Southern thing. Wasn't that, you remember that? Oh, yeah. You'd be a good boy. And somehow that got in me. And when I was in my first experience in college, I was not a good boy. I was trying to be a Christian and I was trying to follow God, but the serious stuff started showing up and I wasn't doing real well with it. And so my first strivings in the faith were not, again, not intellectual or philosophical, or even, in a sense, they were spiritual and not even necessarily theological per se, but they were struggles with this dissonance that began to set into my life. If I was going to follow God and be serious about God and want to know God, what do I do with this evil that isn't going away? And so that was one of the first serious struggles. It was during my college years that I did decide, indeed, that I was serious about this and that I had made a commitment. I was sticking with this commitment. And even though I didn't understand everything, and even though it was a struggle, and I knew I was still very much a broken sinner, I couldn't get rid of the sin in my life as a Christian. Being a Christian didn't help me very much at that point. But I was serious about it. And it was during that first phase, that college time, that I also got involved through the Bible studies and the people, the students, fellow students on campus, in a large international student college ministry, and began to imbibe their teaching. And they were very, very highly focused on evangelism. That really, if you want to make sense of your Christianity, it was about winning people to the gospel. It was about winning people to Christ. And so I threw myself into that, because at that point, what I was being taught was that the heart and core of someone who's striving to know God and to be serious about their commitment to faith, the equation was, if you were serious about your faith, that equals the commitment that would get you involved in wanting to win others to the gospel as well. Very strong culture. And back in those days, in the 60s and 70s, the church in general, the evangelical church in this culture, in our country, was heavily, heavily, heavily involved and culturally committed. Church cultural, evangelical Christian culture was heavily committed to evangelism. And that was the path. It was winning the world. It was during that time that I ran into my first intellectual issues, and they took the form of if you're trying to share the gospel with somebody and they're not particularly convinced, then you start pulling out your reasons to believe. And so I pulled out my apologetics, started reading apologetics, reading reasons to believe. And there were all kinds of authors that were at the time involved in that. God's existence, Christ, the reality and reliability of the texts of the Bible, the authenticity and reality of the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, and the proofs or evidence that was true. Those became issues that I studied and that seemed compelling to me. I wasn't It wasn't problematic to me. But those were the first, if you want to put in intellectual terms, those were the first things that I began to really struggle with. So that was the first exploration of my faith. And of course, back in those days, again, we're talking 60s and 70s, this was the time when the other major motif that happened in a lot of the conservative evangelical church culture was that the end of the world was coming soon. The second coming was happening very quickly. It's like we're talking 60s and 70s, and by 1983 or 4, we could all be out of here. The late great planet Earth. Us oldsters, we... Yeah, it's all going to be ended. So between the fact that the end of the world was coming and Jesus was going to come back, and you had to keep your spirituality going so that you wouldn't get left behind, and evangelism, I mean, you can feel the power, the constraining powers that are at work in my life as a Christian, pushing me toward evangelism and really thumbing my nose at other kinds of careers. I mean, this was the most important spiritual sign of your piety and your commitment that you could get involved in. So that's what I did. Okay, second phase. As I got involved in this international evangelical evangelistic movement, where Christianity was largely about reaching the world with the gospel, reaching the world for Christ, got involved. This was the time, passing through quickly a phase where I met my lovely wife, we got married, graduated from college, and moved right into working with this organization, and moved on to their staff, and I thrived on working with students and enjoyed very much my interaction with students, finding students, interacting with them, sharing the gospel as best I understood what that was at the time. And I loved it. And at the end of that period, that was about a six-year period, we moved from Minneapolis to Los Angeles, to San Bernardino, and then to Orange County. And then some dissonance started showing up again. Not, I hadn't gotten rid of the sin issue. That was still a very live issue. I knew I wasn't, in spite of the fact that I had techniques taught me as to how to rid myself of my failures, my moral failures. They didn't really work. Actually, it wasn't them that didn't work. It was me that didn't work. That's what I thought. If I just did the thing that they were telling me to do, I'd be okay. But see, I never came up with the right wherewithal to be able to do that. But I loved working with students. And the dissonance that rose up in my life at that point was, it was another issue of realization that, I'm going to use the board here if I can get this to work. As I observed the experience of the typical person who'd become a believer, especially a young person, it seemed to me that if we say that we all have lenses through which we look at the world, like a worldview set of lenses here. You don't get it? what I was realizing was, as I got more out into the world and interacted with more university students and got more familiar with university culture and academic and philosophical issues, what I realized was that my Christianity, if you want to say that my faith was a big part of my worldview lens, my Christianity explained my personal world. If you want to talk about young people, that would involve, and I was married at this point and beyond a lot of this stuff, but studies, school, girlfriends, sports, your family, going to church. I mean, there's a world that you live with when you're young, and if you learn Christianity at that young age, your Christianity has to come to, it explains, you learn it in this personal world, and it explains that personal world. But then when you start encountering the world, the series of questions, the series of issues, and this is where a dissonance started setting up. As I became more and more familiar with the intellectual challenges to Christianity, or just the questions of trying to figure out how do I make sense of my humanity and does my Christianity explain that? It's as if, in a sense, my Christianity explained this narrow personal world, but I hadn't learned a Christianity that in which I could actually think about philosophical issues, sociological issues in terms of the university, other religions, the complexities of psychology. I mean, you can just go on down the line and gather up the issues that will, in the modern secular world, will challenge Christian faith. So the dissonance that I was speaking of is the fact that my Christianity explained this much of the world, but it certainly did not address these larger issues that increasingly started showing up on my radar screen. My apologetics for the faith explained some of it, but there were a lot of things that it didn't explain. And that experience began to kind of rock my world. And I thought the answer was, well, what I need to do is to go off to seminary. I need to go get theological education, and then I'll learn, and then I'll have the answers, and that will solve my problem. So what I thought at the time was that my answer was more education, which in certain degree was true. The interesting thing is that right when I was on the faculty or on the staff of this large organization, international evangelistic organization, and had been around the country and had some interesting experiences for 5 or 6 years, a fellow from a guy who was on staff who was older than I asked me Carol and I wanted to go overseas. And so it became a choice of, well, do I leave this organization, or can I get the organization, argue the organization into letting me go to seminary for a while and get my answers, or do I want to take this opportunity to go out of my culture and be in a totally different situation, continuing my work in trying to explain the gospel to young people, high school, college age people, but in a different context. And that's the choice that we made. So we were reassigned. We went to London. And that was 1970-71. And that starts the third phase of my life, as I'm kind of outlining it here tonight. Being out of my own culture, back in those days, you wouldn't necessarily think about English culture. I didn't know. I had no idea that going out of the American culture into just English culture, I figured it was going to be like us, right? It just blew the walls off. I remember sitting on the train going in from Heathrow Airport, on the train, looking over London, out the window of the train, and thinking, oh my gosh, I could already feel the cultural shift happening in my life, and it was terrorizing. And that was one of the healthiest things that could have happened to me at this point. I began working. I was asked to help develop a outreach and organization to reach to British young people in London. So I worked in the north part of London. I was the only worker there who was American. I worked with a British fellow. And we developed works in about 8 or 9 schools in northern London. What was interesting and significant about that with regard to the story tonight is that I had to work with upper, middle, lower class British kids. I worked with Jewish kids. I worked with Hindu kids. I worked with Irish kids. I worked with this smorgasbord of ethnicity and religious background. So my Christianity at that point was being challenged and confronted with issues that were very complex and very challenging to me personally. It was a wonderful experience, and I worked like crazy to establish relationships with these students that I was meeting and interacting with and having coffee with and talking about Christianity with and talking about their religious background. But it really raised the bar in terms of what I didn't know. So again, I thought, well, I don't know what I'm talking about. I've really got to get to school, get some theological education, and that will really help. It was also at that time that I was first given a book by Francis Schaeffer. Now, last week Nancy gave the story, and I think all of us in our age group, which is now getting older, back in those days in the 60s and 70s, Francis Schaeffer came along in the Libri ministry and was in many, many ways a serious godsend and a great encouragement, specifically regarding this tension right here of having a Christianity that explains this much of the world, my personal cultural world, and my experience, and then confronting the huge world beyond the boundaries of my experience and my own Christian culture. Francis Schaeffer came along and started presenting in his books ways to start thinking about these things that were incredibly helpful. For one thing, the term worldview emerged back in those days for me, and that was a new, helpful concept to realize that everyone has a worldview. Everyone has a way of looking at the world, looking at themselves, making sense of the world, giving answers to their experience of the world and themselves, and that there were a set of certain fundamental questions that any worldview was going to answer, whether it be a Hindu worldview, a Buddhist worldview, or an American middle-class business worldview, or no matter what worldview it is, at one level or another, a worldview is a way of looking at the world that's attempting to make sense of the world and provide answers to big questions, the biggest kinds of questions. And Francis Schaeffer was incredibly helpful in that. I don't want to go into too many details about that, except to say that at that point there was a revolution in my thinking that centered on the issue of, for the first time in my life, having been a Christian now for, at that point, would have been 11 or 12, 13 years, I realized that there was not a tension. There didn't have to be a dissonance between believing my faith, embracing my faith, and thinking. That there wasn't a dichotomy between those two. That I didn't have to put my mind on a shelf in order to believe. That in fact, modeled in the person of Francis Schaeffer and his ministry with many colleagues and co-workers, there was this modeling of the fact of someone who was not afraid of intellectual issues, who was actually embracing the challenge of thinking and integrating that thinking into their believing as a Christian. Now, for many of you, that may be a taken for granted thing. Maybe you grew up with that. Maybe you had parents, or you grew up in a family, or you were in a church where that was kind of a meat and potatoes experience, but it wasn't for me. And the sense of liberation, a sense of, if you to use the modern term, the sense of empowering that came from understanding that I didn't have to run intellectually in order to embrace my faith in Christ, was a huge issue. Along with that, for the very first time, I, again, largely influenced through Francis Schaeffer's ministry and his books, and then people that were, other books I meant, reading and running into other people who had similar gifts that I was reading at the time, I realized that Christianity, the gospel, is about being human. And it threw up a set of questions for me that sort of redefined and shifted the paradigm for me too, from sort of, well, I have this religion, this is my faith, this is my religious world, to a much more universal picture of, wait a minute, put that aside for a minute. Just ask the question, what does it mean to be a Christian, or to be a human being? And again, reflecting on the work that Dr. Schaefer's books helped with, it was a matter of seeing for the very first time that asking that question was a vital question. It was at the center, in many ways, of my life existentially, in terms of who I was as a person, deciding the big questions. One of the central questions was, what does it mean to be a human being? And a couple of observations that emerged at that point. One is, to drag out my little diagram again, there are two observations that occurred to me. One was that Dr. Schaefer talked about the universe being like a closed room, like a box in a sense, that the universe, that the modern world looked at the universe as being closed. That is to say, the way the modern secular mind conceived of reality through their lenses, through their worldview, was that God didn't exist. The process of what's talked about in sociology is that the process of secularization had pushed God, the notion of God, from reality, pushed the notion of God, especially the personal God of the Bible, from the realms of everyday relevance to the point where it was irrelevant, and God, in Nietzsche's terms, is dead. And we killed him. So if there is no God in the picture, then what we are left with is a universe that basically exists on the basis of time plus matter plus chance. Time plus matter plus chance equals the universe. And as I began to think about that, it was a very compelling, if you started with certain assumptions, that's where you end up. If God is not there, then you have these human beings running around the earth, and you have, you know, birds and trees and mountains and clouds and stuff happening, but ultimately time plus chance plus matter is what results in what exists. So our psychology, the immaterial, the subjective psychology of an individual, again, is just a byproduct of a chance configuration or a collocation of atoms at a certain point in history. And what you end up with is a universe in which here's this human being trying to figure out who he is, in a universe that they've already determined has no ultimate transcendent answers. It only has answers that would come in the box. The second observation is that if that's true, then if we start with matter and time and chance, if this is the origin, oops, got snagged. If this is the origin of all things, if all things are generated from this, which is what the modern secular world is suggesting, then there are certain things that you can draw, conclusions you can draw from that. One conclusion you can say is that there's no design to what exists because there's no designer. This is not a design. This is chance. You can ask the question, where did this stuff come from, which takes you back to the Big Bang question, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But really, this is what people have decided in the modern and postmodern world is the basis of reality and the ground of reality. And so there's no purposeful design behind it. The second thing is there's no, if that's true, then there's no real purpose. You cannot derive purpose from this except one that's grounded in the box, one that would be constructed within the box and has no ultimate transcendent meaning or attachment, nothing universal about it. It's just it would just be a cultural construct within the box. So there's no purpose, and no, in that sense, no meaning. We can also say that there's no... there's a huge issue regarding good and evil. So there's no foundation for determining ethics or morality, ultimately. You have to construct things only on a temporary cultural historical basis within the box, given cultures. And what do you do if two cultures opposite each other on the world have completely different notions of good and evil, and who's right? I mean, ultimately, when we have lots of what's true, what's right, lots of human interaction activity that we call war that has come from differences of opinion about these kinds of things. So there's no foundation for ethics or morality. And the last thing that we can say is that ultimately the universe is impersonal. And what I mean by that is that there is no person, there's no personal creator here. So the logical extension of this would be that there's no personhood. So what does the creature in the box, the human being in the box, what does that creature decide it means to be a person? I mean, is there any way to define what a person is, ultimately? Well, these were the kinds of questions that I began to work with. And I began to ask my faith, my biblical understanding, these questions, and I began to grow from those things. These challenges that emerged, that I've tried to point out here in a couple of minutes. These challenges are great dilemmas. And I love a quote that I came across, an artist by the name of Paul Klee, who wrote this in the 1930s, wrote this statement. The ideological capacity of man, that is the philosophical capacity of man, to penetrate earthly and supernatural spaces at the same time. That is to say, at random. In other words, there's something about the human being that is grounded in the earth, grounded here, in this physical reality, in this time-bound reality. But there's also something about the human being that allows the human being to extend to, in a sense, conceptually, the supernatural, something beyond this, something beyond the physical, the empirical, and the physical universe. He says that ability or capacity to penetrate both earthly and supernatural spaces at random, and contrast to the physical boundedness that we have, is the origin of human tragedy. This combat between power on the one hand, the power of the mind, the power of the imagination, the power to leap into ideas and realms beyond our limited capacity, that power and the prostration and limitedness, the finiteness that we feel, implies the discord of human existence. Half winged, half imprisoned, that is man. The revelation that where there is a beginning, there can never be infinity. Now, that last phrase, that last statement, I take to mean, if I'm understanding what he's intending to say here, is that we feel the sense of our limitedness, the sense that we have a beginning, we're alive, we're real, we're experiencing the real world. We're also experiencing this incredible limitation, aside from the fact that we can leap in our imagination and our mind way beyond this limitation. We can imagine other worlds. We can imagine other existences. But in spite of the fact that we can imagine what he calls infinity, we can imagine infinities, the fact of the matter is, where there is something that's finite, there can be, never be, any infinity. In other words, he concludes that this boundedness that we live in is something that this human limitation, this human finiteness, is something that we can never escape, even though we can dream about infinity. A quote from Nietzsche, he says, if we could imagine an incarnation of dissonance, and what is man if not that? That dissonance, in order to endure life, would need a marvelous illusion to cover it with a veil of beauty. In other words, a recognition of reality that a lot of what we bring to the world and foist on our interpretations of the world is that our beauties that with which we try to cover the dissonance. So this problem that I've been talking about for a minute emerged in my own thinking, and I had to answer those questions and come to terms with whether I thought the gospel was the ground of answering those things. And I did. How? What were some of my conclusions? Well, it seemed to me that the gospel itself and the Bible, right at the very beginning, right at the point in Genesis chapter 3 where there is a picture presented to us of a brokenness that happens, a fall, that the problem of those characters, those people in that scenario of Adam and Eve, is that their will and wish, in their impatience to wait for the Creator to provide, in their naive and innocent existence at that point, desired to have a knowledge and an experience and a power that was essentially infinite. That is, they wanted knowledge to transcend what they were. And God had already told them, don't do that. That's a mistake. But the power of the desire and the lust for the infinite, what I'm calling the infinite at this point, was so great because what it represented to them was something that they probably were already feeling. They were feeling this boundedness and this limitedness. And it emerged in their thinking that there was a way to get beyond it, to transcend this experience, to transcend this finiteness, to transcend what they had, and they wanted it. So there's this great desire in us in the human being, it seems to me, according to biblical account, that has a lot of explanatory power in some ways. One of the other observations that occurred to me is that something that sociologist of religion Peter Berger points out. He wrote a book a number of years ago called Rumor of Angels. And there's a section in that book where he talks about signals of transcendence. And with all this dissonance and with all this brokenness and with the darkness in the world, are there signs in the world? Are there signals in the world that indicate that God is there? He suggests yes. He says the signals of transcendence are clues and signs that lead seekers to consider the possibility that human nature and the nature of the world are not accidents of chance. Rather, humans and nature are ordered by something greater than themselves from which they derive meaning. What might these be? These signals are not proofs, but pointers beyond themselves to universals or principles of reality upon which existence itself is ordered and built. What are they? What are some? Here's a handful. The cry for order and meaning. When little children awaken in the night crying from fears, mothers hold them and comfort them with the words, "It will be okay. Everything will be all right. You are safe with me." Implicit in this universal maternal scene is a clue that humans yearn for and require order and meaning. To children, parents embody the safety and comfort that comes from order and meaning. Humans universally cry out for order, meaning, and the safety from threats that are in the world, that are coming from the world. Threats that are often held in check by meaning and order. Something you can count on. The cry for justice. The impact of some evils on the world is so great that these evils are universally repudiated. Even in our day of deeply entrenched moral relativism, everyone finds some evils that are so morally repugnant that we cry out for damnation of the evil and justice for the victim. Even people who are immoral know that there's some evil that just cannot be stood. You can't stand it. So the cry for justice, this universal cry, points to a truth that rises above the whims of culture and the seasons of history, namely that there must be an eternal kind of justice that gives foundation to justice for this world. A pointer, not a proof. The cry of joy. Happiness can be thin and short-lived. True joy, like the healthy birth of a much-desired baby, seems to demand the perpetuation of its own existence. We want that joy to go on. It seems right. It feels good. That's the way the world should be. Something profound about joy captures us. True joy seems so right and good that it deserves to exist forever. The human experience of joy cries out, "Let me be forever." Joy also seems to point to the need for a forever in which it can continue to be true. The cry of love. The same can be said for love as it was said for joy. Even in superficial popular versions of romantic love, there hides an impulse that love can surmount all boundaries. True unconditional love, like that experienced between a parent and a child or within a family, possesses such a character that it seems to surmount ugliness, harm, and the limitations of our finite existence. These cries, or what Peter Berger has called the signals of transcendence, and there were others in the book. These cries for order and meaning and justice and joy and love all seem to point to an authentic human need for bigger, lasting versions of them. lasting versions of them to exist beyond this present world. They seem to say there must be another truer reality which transcends and outshines this present one, an eternal existence in which order, meaning, joy, and love rule over all else. So, we live in a world in which the pressure and reality around us in the world, in the modern secular world around us, is one in which God could be a personal, private belief, but in terms of being so real that we ought to rule our lives and civilization based on that, that is passé. That's gone. And yet, what I was observing was that there were these things you can point to that seem to indicate there's something beyond this. Again, not proofs, but strong pointers towards something that we could seek after and try to find some sense of reality for in our lives. The next phase of my experience is what I call the culture faith phase. And what I mean by that is, I came, when I was in London, the issue of the reality of hidden culture for me became very real. And I realized that, in a certain sense, there was a force on me at that point to realize, you know, if you're a Hindu or a Buddhist, and you're living in India or Korea, and you're raised in a certain religious framework, there's a certain cultural power, a certain plausibility for believing that, certain forces, cultural forces that are at work that make believing that so real. So why wouldn't there be? Why wouldn't various religions be believable, given the forces of culture in them? And of course, that's a huge question. And I certainly wouldn't want to stand here tonight and say that I've plumbed all those religions and decided from my studies, intensive studies, that Christianity is the one I choose. But I have surfed around there a bit, and I did. But the main point is that culture arose up in my life and my experience as a believer, as a Christian, to be this issue. I remember in this next phase, it started in London, of course, and being out of my culture. But when I came back to the States, we lived in Philadelphia for a year, where I started some theological studies. And then we came back to Portland, where our family, to be nearer our family, and I started school there, seminary there as well, to try to finish it. And I got a job working in a church as a youth worker, youth pastor, and college pastor. And I remember we'd drive to school, come home, and go to work. And from the freeway where you would get off to the church, there was this gully. You would have to drive down into it. It was not a valley, but it was this geographical dip that you could go down. And right at the bottom of the dip, there was a little Jehovah's Witness church, Kingdom Hall. And most Jehovah's Witnesses' Kingdom Halls are really humble little buildings. And this one was. But I remember driving past this day after day after day. And I was in school at seminary. And I was being a youth pastor. And this question of culture had begun to emerge in my life. And I began to think about, well, wait a minute. It just had occurred to me that why, if I were being a good evangelical Christian leader, believer, what made me think that my religious experience, my truth for my faith, was more valid or more real or truer than that little Kingdom Hall, the people who were in that Kingdom Hall? I mean, that triggered this question of religion being able to function for you. That religion can be something that orders your world, gives meaning to your life, gives you a ground for morals and ethics. And there's There's a certain sense in which you just look at the way religion functions from again, take some of the world religions, that those religions are grids or maps or worldviews, if you will, that try to explain reality, and they function for people. Apart from the fact of whether they really are true or not, or whether all of the elements within them are true or not, they function effectively. Explaining how culture works with faith became a big deal to me. And I had to work with myself in coming to terms with that question, because it seemed to me that this was something that was quite important. That question just kind of hung there for a long time. I didn't abandon my faith. I didn't have a deep struggle with it, but it raised an intellectual issue for me. It raised something that I was trying to come to terms with. In the meantime, we finished school, seminary in Portland, and came to Eugene to start a PhD program here at the university. And I think it was the second class that I took in the program. I was working full-time and starting grad school. And one of the first classes I took came up against this issue, and it was really, really helpful. What I came to realize is that culture is something that human beings create. It's a construct. And as in this little diagram here, we talk about culture. Culture or making extends something from the human being out into the world, and it's either an idea or a thing. In other words, we create something, and we create an idea, a language, a concept, or we create a thing, a machine, an object, or something. And that these ideas and things become culture. That those are the things. The language we use, the medicines that we use—I mean, it just the fabric of the culture that we live in—we create. Once something is created, it becomes, if you will, a fact on its own out here. Once you create a car, an automobile, you create a philosophy and you write it down. Once it's out there, it separates itself from the maker. It becomes a fact on its own out here. And then it has the power, once it has this sort of facticity to it, it can act back on us. That culture shapes us. Culture shapes us. And it does it in two ways. One way is that it acts in ways that we're conscious of. We are intellectually, cognitively aware of ideas and language, and we're aware of those things. There's another sense in which culture can act back on us in a hidden way. What Peter Berg calls the taken for granted dimensions of culture. What's significant about this, and I'll just say hidden, these hidden aspects of culture, what's hidden about them is that they're like the water to the fish. You don't really notice them. Until you go out of your own culture or have some kind of experience that points the existence of these things out. I tell a story, and I'll do it very quickly. When we lived in London, the first place we lived in, I walked into the kitchen when we were looking for this place and deciding to rent it. And I walked into the kitchen and I saw the counter, and I noticed this little dishwasher over in the corner. And then I realized, no, that's not a dishwasher. And I walked over and it was a refrigerator. It was a little refrigerator about this big. And that was what British refrigerators were. They weren't big, fat American refrigerators. They were little refrigerators. And I was incredulous. I was incredulous. How can this be? You can't live with a refrigerator that big. It pointed out a cultural reality that I had simply imbibed this notion of refrigerators are like this. They're not like that. Another one. Up the hill, Hampstead Heath, there was a road that went out of Hampstead to the north. And traffic, if you got caught in there, you were done. It was a two-lane, little, you know, typical London road, little two-lane cow path that became a highway, a little road. And right at this one place, there was the edge of a wall came to the edge of one side of the lane, and the other side, in the other lane, was an oak tree. An oak tree. That oak tree took up the whole lane. I'm thinking, whoa. I mean, you couldn't go around it because there was a wall on the other side. So every day at traffic, the British folks that used that road would simply take turns passing around that tree. They would have to stop in the traffic, let one car go, then another car would go, and they would just take turns. Back and forth, back and forth. And being in my American freeway mentality, you can imagine how that cultural shock hit me. Now, the notions of a refrigerator and an oak tree taking up half a road, those are cultural expectations and realities that they were fine with. And mine were different and fine and setting from me. But the point is that they were hidden from me. And what I began to see, and I have to speed it up a little bit here, is that my Christianity, my experience of Christianity had been deeply, deeply infected by my American culture. As a matter of fact, my notions of spirituality, what it meant to be a serious follower of Christ, were highly inflected by certain cultural... They were biblical ideas that had been so shaped by culture that they weren't biblical anymore. Now, this culture phase that I'm talking about was a huge, important part of my story. Because all of a sudden, in this graduate class that I took, just all the lights started going on, all the way back into my college days, where I had been taught by very well-meaning Christians that there are certain things you can do, certain techniques you can apply, certain pietistical practices that were, as I look back at my experience, were driven and given character by the American business model, by a kind of entrepreneurial spirit. In fact, one of the early, when we started the study center, there was one fellow who was greatly encouraging from Regent College. And he taught a course up there on sort of the history of spirituality. And he suggested that if you look at church history, each period of church history has a hero or a model. So in the early church, the hero or the model was the martyr. So if you were truly serious about your faith, martyrdom was a distinct possibility. And that was highly, I mean, in a sense, that was the pinnacle of spirituality. Period right after that, when the church became adopted by the state, by Constantine, the church became infected by civilization, by power, by kingly political power. And the model of spirituality that emerged in that period was the desert recluse, or the desert ascetic. The one who escapes from the powers and shapes of worldly Christianity and goes to the desert. And he said there were several models like this. One of the model during the Reformation was the soldier, he suggested. You know what the model for our year, our era is? He suggested the entrepreneur. That the missionary age that begins in the 19th century, early 19th century, is highly inflected. The model of piety and spirituality is highly inflected by the entrepreneurial spirit. That is, we're out there to do mission work, gather the world to Christ, and that energy and focus on the entrepreneur. How do we get it done? Do, 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 do. Became our model. And that's all culture. Those are cultural forces. They're taking good biblical notions and biblical teachings, in a sense, and when they get moved into a certain cultural setting, they become warped. Those were really, really helpful elements. And the intellectual part of my journey was greatly aided by realizing the power of culture in my faith personally. And so in those years following his conversion, some 13 or 14 years, whatever it was, he came to understand the essential message of the faith, going back to the beginning. And then he saw the essential message of the faith in Christ, in what Christ had taught him and what he had learned. And he was able to, if you will, disenculturate the gospel from its Jewish embeddedness. He was able to make a distinction between essential Christianity, essential faith, saving faith, and the Jewish culture in which it was found, in which it lived historically. In order that he might be able to go to the Gentile culture and then re-embed essential Christianity into that culture, and be able to make discernments about what's just cultural and what's essential. So in one case, we see Paul saying Timothy is not going to get circumcised, and then in another context, Timothy gets circumcised. Those reading two different cultural situations. So culture became a big issue. I'm going to leave a couple minutes for questions here. I'm going to skip over some things. The last phase, I kind of circle back. And come to terms with, as I grew older in the faith, and I went through a series of intellectual, philosophical considerations, any one of which could have really challenged my faith. And in fact, as I came through it, they did challenge my faith. The more I studied, the more I was privileged to understand what biblical Christianity really is, what biblical faith really is. That faith really stood those tests. In other words, essential, powerful, biblical faith was able to meet those challenges where they were for me and answer for me the questions that emerged along the way. Now, it's a story that doesn't admit of any particular point where I became an atheist or I gave it up or some other kind of thing like that, but it definitely represents a story within my experience of how I had to come to terms with certain issues that were real challenges to my faith. They were problematic to my faith. The last one, and the last point I want to make is that once a person awakens to themselves and really as age and time and experience allows you to see yourself, one of the things that will emerge is that you really are, and it can take different forms, I think, but this world is not a happy place. I am not a successful human being. There are things about me that I really, that really repulse me, if I am able to look deeply inside. And of course, Christianity calls me to look, at myself. It puts a mirror of moral beauty up to me. And when I look in that mirror, I realize, oh my gosh, I am in trouble. So one of the great emerging questions that abides in my life, and it's not just an intellectual issue, but it becomes a spiritual issue, is what do I do with my ongoing struggle with my own moral failure and sin? And those points where I still want to rebel against God. And of course, the gospel offers me an answer to that. Mercy. Grace. Through simply continuing to trust that God is going to work that out, to trust his graciousness. The other issue is that truth, what it's come to for me is that a realization that Christianity is interested in the truth. It's not interested in things that are not true. My human quest needs to be completely open. I'm morally and spiritually bound to want what's true. What's emerged over the years as my faith has been challenged again and again and again in many different ways is that the truth, what appears to be the truth and might lie outside the faith in some way or not explained by the faith in some way, eventually they find themselves coming together. A quote that I love by Simone Weil on this regard. For it seems to me certain, quoting, for it seems to me certain that one can never wrestle enough with God if one does so out of pure regard for the truth. Christ likes us to prefer the truth to him before being Christ, because before being Christ, he is the truth. Even if one turns aside from him to go toward the truth, one will not go far before falling into his arms. So this issue that is actually still a very live issue for us today and for all Christians for whom thinking is not, it's not an option. We're thinking about the world, thinking about ourselves. This issue of truth is a huge issue. And my experience has been that as I hold out a quest for the truth, that my faith meets me there. I need to stop there and leave a couple of minutes here for questions. If you have a question or two, or you want to make a remark.
Hi, thanks. It's on. Thanks for your talk. There's a lot of interesting things. You talked only briefly about it, but I liked your mention of Paul's success at disenculturation, you know, removing the gospel from its Jewish context and putting it into different contexts so that it could be communicated, the kernel of it could be communicated successfully to all different kinds of people. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how and why you think he was successful in doing that and whether or not we can emulate that.
That's a really good question. I'm not sure I have a really good answer. It seemed to me that,
he didn't have any choice. He had to do that if he felt that his calling was to the mission or the mission to the Gentile world, that was a part and parcel, a challenge that he was going to have to take on. So in Galatians, for example, we see him confront Peter over an issue in which Peter started to cave into religious practices and religious cultural pressure, and Paul calls him on it. And it must have been, the only thing we can conclude is that in Paul's careful
analysis and rumination over what he heard from Jesus and what he was taught by his fellow apostles over the years, that he was a very, very brilliant man, and he was able to put together a picture in which he could make those delineations. And I don't know that I don't know how he did that. All I know is he did do it, and we see the evidence of it in the New Testament letters. Seems to me we have to do the same thing. From my experience and just a little bit about what I shared with you tonight, if we don't do that, we stand at great risk of really missing important biblical truth. It's not that we can't be believers and be mistaken in our theology or mistaken or culturally warped in some understanding, but in order to live in a way that if we're compelled by the idea that this Christianity has to make sense at every level, it somehow has to come together and make sense of my humanity and my experience, and I have to put that all together. It's a challenge that we all have to take on. So in my experience right now, I have an opportunity occasionally to interact with a lot of pretty crazy contemporary artists. And they have a world of their own, a culture and a language of their own, and I've had the opportunity to get to be able to imbibe that and understand it a bit, and I can dialogue with them. And that's a culture, and that is something that is very intriguing to me in terms of being able to address some of those issues through their language and through their culture. It's very similar to what any mission would face.
One thing kind of notable in that regard that just strikes me now is that when you read Paul's letters, he does talk about Judaism, over and against, the Christian take on the Old Testament and then Christ's fulfillment of the law. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't really, he doesn't have to deal with this is why Buddhism is wrong, X, yeah. X, 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 X. Right. And he doesn't have these other mm-hmm. competing, mm-hmm. Or maybe competition is the wrong model. Maybe that's why, maybe that's an extension of
the... Well, he did have to confront certain issues. Like, for example, we do have examples in, was it Acts 17, where he's in Athens? And he's the Areopagus, and he does some...
Yeah, but it's a blanket, right? All this is garbage sort of thing.
Jack, do you have a thought on that, Jack? Any particular?
No, I think David's right. Mostly what you have in the New Testament is the discipline.
Right. Yeah. Larry?
You mentioned the different stages that Berger had regarding spirituality. Mm-hmm. Was it Berger?
Yeah, Peter Berger. Peter Berger, the Peter Signals Berger, of
yes.
Transcendence, you mean
yeah.
those?
Yeah. I was wondering if... When you, your,
oh, James Houston.
James Houston.
Yeah.
Oh, okay,
the,
that's who
history,
it was.
The history with the different models.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
James Houston.
Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering if what you were thinking today about this entrepreneurial model, and would you include? It seems to me that part of where our culture is today is into comfort and entertainment, and I wonder if. Or that's kind of the model.
Hmm.
And I wonder if you would see that connected to entrepreneurship, or do you see that as a separate, or would you even agree with that?
No, I think it's part of it. I think the reason in the modern American commodity culture, the entrepreneurialism, I think there's something in the fabric of the American ethos, the pragmatism that's built into our ethos, that where we're kind of a go-getter kind of culture. But that's been highly hedonized. So our hedonism is made possible by the entrepreneurial success that we have.
Right.
But then once we have the success, the actual goal is the fruit, the toys, and the leisure, and the pleasures that come from the fruit of that entrepreneurial. And that whole package is It's what Kierkegaard calls the aesthetic. That is, that we can simply drug ourselves into that realm and not have to worry about bigger questions.
So I was thinking about the consequences of the four spiritual laws.
Yeah. Yeah. We probably need to let you go. We're out of time here, so thank you very much. I appreciate it.